Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to part one of M.M. Phelps' account of the Battle of Tsushima and the events that led up to the battle. Recorded 1st of August 1975 and duration 47 minutes.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I have chosen to speak on the Russo-Japanese War of 1905 not only because of the overall military activities as a whole interested me, but for the reason that the climactic naval conflict fought off Tsushima Island, that's the island of the donkey's ears, from the 27th to the 29th of May 1905 has long held a special fascination for me. For instance, and principally, the Battle of Tsushima was fought at the only period in history when the steam-powered ironclad line of battleship was supreme and before aircraft and submarine-launched torpedoes seriously threatened its existence. Admirals Togo and Rozhdestvensky were the only commanders ever to lead their fleets into a full-scale, breech-loaded gunnery battle. Tsushima was to the ironclad's finest hour, the one occasion in its brief history when it fulfilled its functions without interference. It should be remembered, however, that the torpedo occupied an extremely important place in this war, being launched in the main from comparatively well-developed ocean-going torpedo boats, which were a part of the fleets of both sides. When combined with battleship artillery, which in the principal opposing vessels represented the latest state of the art, the threat of torpedo attack forced both fleets to fight at hitherto unprecedented long range. And of course, broadside slugging matches could no longer be tolerated. Insofar as communications was concerned, wireless telegraphy, even though used by both sides, was still very much in its crude infancy. Indeed, the principal method used by the Russian commander-in-chief, and this is in 1905, to communicate with the Admiralty in St. Petersburg, which is now, of course, Leningrad, was by coded message passed through the regular international cable service. Now, throughout this lecture, at some periods, you're going to come across the word caliber quite a bit. Now, this would surely be one of the most abused words in the lexicon, mainly used to describe the actual diameter of the hole in the piece of metal that flings the other piece of metal. Well, it's not quite true, because caliber really represents the length of the barrel of the gun concerned. For instance, if one is talking of a 12-inch 40 caliber weapon, that's 12-inch actual diameter of the bore, and 40 calibers long, so that's 40 times 12, so it means a 40-foot barrel from breech to muzzle. So that is really what the word caliber means. Although, of course, in common usage, people usually say a 45 pistol, and I think everyone knows what they're talking about. Now, in this, the first part of my lecture, I will be concentrating on how this battle came to be, for it was only the inevitable result of years of diplomatic wrangling between many nations, and continual pinpricking armed clashes both on land and at sea. And the final climax was the encirclement, the siege and capture of Port Arthur by the Japanese, which I will not be discussing, and the unparalleled but doomed 18,000-mile voyage of rescue undertaken by the cobbled-together 2nd Pacific Squadron, which will be the subject of the next and final part of my story. Now, since original source material on this conflict is almost unobtainable here, being so far as we are from Russia and Japan, I've drawn much of my information from such works as the Imperial Russian Navy, and that's by Fred Jane himself, Westwood's The Russo-Japanese War, Warner's Great Battle Fleets, Richard Howe's various works, and as many copies of early Jane's as I could lay my hands on. And that wasn't too many. As well as that, I was lucky enough to obtain access to quite a few back issues of the Army and Navy journals of 1897 and 98, which provided quite a bit of photographic material. Lastly, I was reminded whilst preparing these lectures of a letter written by the great French philosopher and writer Voltaire to one Monsieur Bertin de Rocheret. And in that letter he said, and I almost looked upon this as a standard cop-out, "A man who ventures to write or communicate contemporary history must expect to be criticized both for everything he has said and everything he has not said." So through this, please bear with me. And so on to other things. Now, the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-05, which began with the Japanese naval attack, had its origin in the simultaneous determination of both Russia and Japan to develop spheres of influence, that is, markets and political leverage in the Far East, mainly at the expense of China, who at this stage was pretty well riddled with foreign concessions. Japan fought a very successful war against the moribund Chinese Empire in 1894-95, in which actually Admiral Togo took a leading part as a captain on board the ship Naniwa, which was actually in the last action, under, of course, another captain. And because of her defeat of China, she imposed a very hard treaty, modelling her negotiations, like her army, on the Prussian system, which had defeated France in 1871, and China had to pay a very heavy war indemnity to Japan and Formosa, and got Port Arthur and the outer Formosan Islands with its hinterland. Now, other great powers, while having no objection to the indemnity, did feel that Japan should not gain Port Arthur, for they had their own ambitions in that part of the world, and Russia persuaded France and Germany to join her in applying diplomatic pressure on Tokyo, with the result that Japan was obliged to relinquish Port Arthur. 2 years later, Moscow bullied Peking into leasing Port Arthur to Russia, together with the peninsula on which it stood, and for Russia this meant that she now had an ice-free naval base in the Far East to supplement Vladivostok. And for Japan, it was a case of insult added to injury. The Chinese Boxer Rebellion of 1900 caused the European powers and Japan to send troops to China to suppress the rebels, and when the fight was over, Russian troops were occupying Manchuria. Now, Russia promised to withdraw these forces by 1903, but she failed to do so, not the first time, wishing to hold Manchuria as a springboard for further expansion of her sphere of influence. And meanwhile, Japan was engaged in all kinds of murderous intrigues in Korea, successfully increasing her influence in that country. But Russia also had an interest in Korea, and although at first the Russians and the Japanese managed to coexist peacefully, it was not long before suspicions on both sides, and they were quite justified, led to tension. Now, negotiations began in 1901, but they made little headway. Japan then strengthened her position with an alliance with Britain, and this alliance meant that if Japan was at war in the Far East, and a third power entered the fight against Japan, then Britain would make a fourth player on Japan's side. Now, during her prevarications in the negotiations with Japan, Russia did not expect the Japanese to go to war. After all, Japan was a newly emergent country, and her naval officers might have been trained in Britain and her army officers in Germany, but several of those officers had begun their military careers, believe it or not, wearing armour and carrying a battle axe. Because it was only in 1853 that Perry, Commodore Perry, actually opened Japan to trade with the West. The Russian army was the world's most powerful, or at least that's what the world believed, and the Japanese had other ideas. They knew that they could not beat Russia in a long war, but they would, in a short war, that they would be able to manage to localize in the Far East. Now, the Russian supply line was a single-track Trans-Siberia railway, which meant that supplies and men would be a long time coming to the Far East if a scrap did stop. And, as it was, Russia did not have large land forces stationed in the Far East. But although Japan was developing fast, she did not seem to be in the big power league. Population was only 46 million in 1903, and she was about one-third the size of Russia, which had a 440 million population at that stage. Now, in terms of economic strength, Japan's national revenue was calculated at approximately £25 million sterling, as against Russia's 208 million. So even though she was a peasant economy, she wasn't broke. Russia's vast economic assets meant that she would be better able to borrow than Japan, other things being equal, and be able to borrow money abroad for any war she might care to undertake. Now, in terms of numbers of men available for service, the disparity was less. Russia's conscription system allowed many exemptions so that her enormous manpower was not fully utilized. But if all her reserves were utilized, Russia would be able to muster about 4,500,000 active troops, and that's including the Navy. However, such a complete mobilization was not attempted during the war. Despite defeats, Russia was never in mortal danger during the war against Japan. Japan disposed of about 850,000 men, and in addition could draw on over 4 million untrained reserves in an emergency. These figures by themselves were misleading, for what counted was the number of troops which could be deployed on the battlefields of the Far East, and in this respect Russia was inferior to Japan. At the outbreak of the war, Russian strength in the Far East was less than 150,000, and reinforcements could only be a slow process. And that's even after the reservists were assembled. They had to be transported thousands of miles over that single track and incomplete Trans-Siberian Railway. Japan, on the other hand, provided she had control of the sea, could easily ship her forces to Korea and Manchuria. Now, the Japanese fleet at this stage, this is about 1903, possessed 6 modern battleships, together with 6 armoured cruisers which could be regarded as scaled-down battleships, and all of the big ships were built in Britain, as were the majority of the smaller vessels. Now, 2 additional armoured cruisers, originally ordered from Chile at about 1888, and which were built in Italian yards, were on their way to Japan, having been purchased by the Japanese government, but by the time the Japs got hold of them, the Chileans hadn't treated them very kindly and they were in a pretty unseaworthy condition. The Russian Navy was considerably larger than the Japanese, but was divided between the Baltic, the Black Sea, and the Far East squadrons. The latter was being strengthened. It was known then as, still as the 1st Pacific Squadron. And when the war broke out, a new battleship was on its way east, but it had to turn back since it could no longer reach Port Arthur without great risk. The Russians also had at advanced stages of construction in the Baltic, a class of 5 new powerful battleships. As a matter of fact, it was one of the few homogeneous classes of ships that they had. And these were due to go east on completion. But even that word completion was something of a doubtful factor, because Russian battleship construction was amongst the slowest of any nation on earth, about 6 years being the norm, 8 years not being uncommon, 10 sometimes happened, and in the 30s, when they were constructing a light cruiser called the Krasny Kavaz, from the time they laid the keel to the time she went into commission, it took 21 years. So if things got out of hand in a hurry, there's a word, I think, to describe their situation. Thus, the opening of the war was well timed by the Japanese. If they'd waited a year longer, the Russians might have had 12 or more battleships based on Port Arthur, but as things turned out, the war started when the Russians had only 7 battleships in the east. In addition, they had 3 armoured cruisers at Vladivostok. In cruisers and torpedo craft, however, the Russians were less than half as strong. Neither side had submarines, but each suspected that the other had them. And if they had, I don't think there would have been much use, as the early Hollands weren't much. Now, the Russian serviceman was reputed to be of a fine physique and great endurance, but was lacking in intelligence and education, the first mainly because of a lousy diet. Initiative, too, was missing. It was said that the officers, too, were brave and enduring, but in large measure they were drawn from the aristocracy, and promotion was very much a matter of favoritism, with the result that they were lazy and incompetent, and a fair few of that type flourished. Now, infantry training was based on shock tactics and close order, and those who have ever had anything to do with close order drill would rather be surprised to learn that it was based on the assumption that the main purpose of the rifle was to serve as a handle for the bayonet. Supply transport system as such consisted almost solely of regimental carts, because there was no transport service as such. I mean, during the war, transport difficulties did result in the formation of an independent transport service, but this was slow to develop, and in any case, it didn't really get underway until the First World War. Now, oddly enough, the best feature of the Russian supply system was a two-wheeled field kitchen, and remained more or less in much the same form all the way through to the Second World War. The military medical corps had no reserve. It was rotten at best, and God help you if you really got wounded, because you could kiss life goodbye, and would have been overwhelmed anyway by the casualties of war, especially in the Far East, if it hadn't been for the assistance of the Red Cross. Now, the Russian land forces at the beginning of the war were put under the command of the then Minister for War, one General Kuropatkin. Kuropatkin was more of a bureaucrat than a general, having never had an active command. He was an admirable staff officer in the Russian-Turkish War and was well fitted to draw up memoranda and to supply data on that which others might have to use. But he was not himself a man of decision. The only experience he'd ever had in battle was of fighting tribes in the outlying areas of the Russian Empire, and he had taken part as a staff officer in a French military expedition in North Africa, but he was totally unsuited for command of large armies in wartime, and he was further handicapped by the Tsar's appointment of one Admiral Alexeyev as, quote, Viceroy of the Far East. Now, Alexeyev was no friend of Kuropatkin in any case, and his position as Kuropatkin's superior gave him opportunities to interfere in the conduct of the land war, opportunities which he didn't hesitate to take. And towards the end of the war, both Alexeyev and Kuropatkin lost their commands anyway, Kuropatkin being relegated to command of an army under the new commander-in-chief, Linievich. But Linievich had no chance of showing how good a general he was, because the war soon ended. And as Kuropatkin later complained, it ended just when the Russian army was about to win great victories. Sometimes I think I've heard that line before. Now, the Japanese servicemen, on the other hand, was very much an unknown quantity when the war started. True, he'd given a good account of himself in the war against China, but the Chinese army and navy had been pretty hopeless anyway. As a matter of interest, Togo had been mixed up in a very nasty little incident in that particular war, he was then in command of his own cruiser, and they came across a British merchantman ferrying Chinese troops. Well, they sank the merchantman. That was pretty inevitable, and of course it tossed a couple of thousand Chinese squaddies into the drink. And that would have been bad enough if they put the boats down to get them, but they didn't. They turned the machine guns on them. The trouble is, they had a Western witness, and it went down like a bag of wet sand, especially back in Western Europe when the word got back, and gave the Japanese Navy a bad reputation for a while. Oddly enough, though, Togo came out of it pretty unscathed. As the war progressed, he was discovered to be strong and enduring. This is the Japanese serviceman. And according to war correspondents, he was, quote, cleanly, loved taking baths. What Western observers found most attractive was his spirit of patriotism and self-sacrifice, which made dying for the emperor and the emperor's ancestors a great honor. Later generations would perhaps regard the Japanese warrior as totally brainwashed from the day he was born, but in 1904, the martial spirit of the Japanese population seemed pretty enviable. Now, the Japanese supply system was better organized than the Russian. Each division had its own supply train, and this could be rapidly expanded by calling up reservists specializing in this service. And in addition, the armies were pretty well equipped with pack animals, and a standard piece of equipment was a light cart which was assigned to two soldiers, and one of which accompanied every platoon. And of course, as they did in the China incident of 1937, the local populace provided most of the heavy labour anyway. Field Marshal Kuropatkin's opposite number on the Japanese side was General Oyama, whose earliest war experience, and it was war experience, was among samurai in the 60s during a civil war. But by 1870, Oyama was military attaché with the Prussian army, which he observed in its victorious campaign against the French. He was evidently much impressed by the surrounding of the French army at Sedan, which ended the Franco-Prussian War, and in the Russo-Japanese War he repeatedly tried to win his own Sedan, but was never quite successful, partly due to his reluctance to take risks. and partly due to the changes which had taken place in warfare since 1870. Now, most of the Japanese staff officers had spent time in Germany or had been trained by the Germans, and like Orama, their approach to warfare was that of the Prussians three decades earlier. And this had both advantages and disadvantages. Perhaps the most important of the former was that the Japanese infantry training was based on the assumption that firepower was the most important factor in wartime. The Japanese admirals, of whom Togo won the most fame, followed British practice. Like most of them, Togo had spent some time in Britain, either attending British naval colleges or supervising the construction of his own country's warships in British yards. And I'll get to Togo later. Unlike the Japanese generals, who discovered that German methods were not always the best, and the admirals had very little chance to, or need to, change their methods or tactics during the war. The tension arose late in 1903 when both sides began to take precautionary measures. Alexeyev asked permission to mobilize his troops, but the Tsar allowed him to put only Port Arthur and Vladivostok on a war footing, although preparations for mobilization were permitted. In Japan, the collection of reservists and the concentration of a fleet of transports at Sasebo commenced in mid-January 1904, and at the end of that month the Russians learned that 60 transports had been assembled at Sasebo, and Alexeyev again asked permission to mobilize. The Tsar replied that in any conflict it was desirable that the Japanese should fire the first shot. Any Japanese activity on the east coast of Korea or on the west side below the 38th parallel should be unmolested. The Japanese forces acting above the 38th parallel should be attacked. There was the 38th parallel, of course, about which the Korean War started quite some time later. On the 1st of February, the Port Arthur squadron left for 4 days of exercises, but this was regarded as a threat by the Japanese command, and the decision was made to begin war against Russia in accordance with plans already made. The Japanese fleet weighed anchor. Its strongest part sailed towards Port Arthur with the aim of destroying the Russian squadron, as already described. But meanwhile, a cruiser squadron proceeded towards Chemulpo. That's now Incheon. Kev, could I have the map, please? The Japanese fleet weighed anchor. Its strongest part sailed towards Port Arthur with the aim of destroying the Russian squadron, as already described. And as I've already said, a cruiser squadron proceeded towards Incheon, the port for the Korean capital of Seoul, and its purpose was to destroy the troop-carrying transports and to destroy the Russian naval detachment at Chemulpo. Well, there's only two ships there anyway, but they were big ones, or one of them was anyway. Tension between Koreans and Japanese in South Korea had recently developed into a civil disturbance, and a number of powers sent warships to Chemulpo to protect their nationals. On the 7th of February, as the Japanese Admiral Uryu approached with his cruisers, destroyers and torpedo boats, there were already in the harbour British, American and French warships, the Russian cruiser Variag and the small gunboat the Kuryats, as well as the Japanese cruiser Chiyoda. During the night of the 7th and 8th of February, the Chiyoda slipped out of the harbour unseen, met Uryu and appraised him of the situation in the harbour. The Japanese forces already knew of the rupture in diplomatic relations between Russia and Japan, but because the Japanese controlled the Chemulpo telegraph, the commanders of the Russian ships were not fully aware of the situation, and they couldn't exactly use carrier pigeons. Uryu decided to enter the port immediately, but during the approach, the Kuryats was seen leaving. Now, unfortunately, I can't get hold of a picture of the Kuryats. I haven't been able to find one anywhere. The Japanese ships closed in on her from both sides, and the torpedo boats maneuvered as if they were about to make a torpedo attack. Now, during this maneuver, one of them ran aground, but the Kuryats was sufficiently unnerved to fire a warning shot. And so, despite what the Russian government thought about who fired the warning shot, it was actually the first shot of the Russian-Japanese war was fired by a Russian gunboat. But the first act of war had already occurred off Japan, when a Russian cargo ship was captured by Japanese ships. The Kuryats then returned to port, followed soon by the Japanese squadron, which began to land troops in full view of everyone else, and nobody did anything about it, at least for a while. Now, the Russian commanders were still unaware of this state of relations between their country and Japan, but this ignorance was short-lived. For the last time in modern history, Yuryu, through the medium of a Japanese and Russian consul, sent an open letter to the commander of the Russian detachment, inviting him to take his ships out of the harbour, where the Japanese would fight him. Now, if he failed to do so, went the letter, then the Japanese would, regretfully, be obliged to fight him inside the harbour. So, they weighed this one up, and at about midday, both Russian ships left harbour to fight six Japanese. The gunnery on both sides was poor, but they managed to set the very egg on fire, and most of her guns were put out of action. She returned to harbour later, and together with the couriers was scuttled. Not much of a fight. Afterwards, the Japanese inhabitants of Chemulpo, who had cheered both of their side from shore, returned to their homes to celebrate further. None of the Japanese ships, nor even the couriers, were actually damaged in the gun battle itself. The couriers, I think, sank herself out of fright. The crews of the Russian ships were later sent back to Russia on board foreign vessels on the honourable understanding that they would take no further part in the war. As a matter of fact, that undertaking was respected. Now we come to a little signal. It is actually for a memo from one section to another in the Russian camp at Port Arthur. It said, at about midnight, everyone was surprised by the squadron opening fire. It appeared that this was night target practice and it soon ceased. But after half an hour, the firing was resumed, and this time it was irregular and ragged. But all the time we thought that it was the target practice of the previous day still continuing. But soon afterwards, all the troops were summoned by the alarm signal to the line of fortifications. Now, Kev, could I have the next shot, please? No, I think we'll bypass that, please. Next. And that was the result. It was not until some hours later that this particular diarist at Port Arthur discovered that what he and his friends had believed to be target practice was indeed a surprise attack by the Japanese Navy against the Russian Far East Squadron. Now, they didn't do too badly. The ship on the right, that's the Retvizan, she was torpedoed. And that one there, I believe, is the Poltava, battleship Poltava. I'm not too sure what this is in the foreground. I haven't been able to find that one out. They say what they believed was to be a target practice was in fact a surprise attack by the Japanese Navy against the squadron. But not far from Port Arthur on the 8th of February, 1904, five flotillas of destroyers had been detached from the Japanese fleet. Their task, at best, was to win the still undeclared war against Russia at one stroke. At worst, to damage the Russian squadron so that it would be in absolutely no condition to risk an engagement with the Japanese battle fleet. Now, the Russian squadron was actually at anchor outside its base at Port Arthur. Its gunners were asleep, and two destroyers were patrolling the approaches aided by searchlights from the cruisers, but no other precautions had been taken. For despite tensions with Japan, Russia still firmly believed she was in fact at peace. That night, in fact, the Admiral's wife was holding a ball. And earlier in the evening, the approaching Japanese flotillas had divided, two flotillas being sent to the nearby Russian commercial port of Dalny to attack Russian ships there. But in fact, Dalny was empty. The other three flotillas continued towards Port Arthur, and at about 22:30 hours, they sighted the lights of the patrolling Russian destroyers, which they succeeded in evading. But during this maneuver, two of the Russian Japanese destroyers collided, and the flotillas lost contact with one another. The first flotilla continued on its course and soon sighted the flashes of a lighthouse by which it was able to fix its position. The Russians hadn't even turned that out. Then, having seen the Russian searchlights sweeping the water, the flotilla reduced speed and quietly approached. It was then about 20 minutes after midnight, and the moon had not yet risen, and the sea reflected only the rays of that searchlight. And still unobserved, the Japanese sailors could make out in the obscurity the indistinct forms of several large ships, of which these two, still afloat of course, were some. It was at this point that the commander of the first flotilla gave the order to attack, and his first destroyer moved in close and at 28 minutes past midnight launched a torpedo against a three-funneled Russian ship, the one on the right, and then another against a two-funneled vessel. And as it retired at full speed, the crew heard the sounds of the explosions. The second destroyer, following in the wake of the first, fired another torpedo at the Reprisan and then made off rapidly. And at this point, according to a Japanese report I found, the enemy seemed to take notice of our attack. I love that sentence. Suddenly there was an uproar on all his ships. Guns began to thunder and a large number of shells began to fall in the vicinity of our destroyers. Destroyer number three, the Kasumi, was illuminated by the enemy searchlights, but as it was not damaged by the firing, it took the opportunity of attacking with a ship with two masts and three funnels, which was subsequently identified to be one of the Pallada class. It saw a column of water and smoke rise up from the side of this ship, and amid shells it retired at high speed towards the south. Now, high speed in those days meant about 28 knots. Its companion at the rear, the Akatsuki, after having several times been caught by searchlights, approached from the port side, and at 23 minutes past midnight went west and attacked the Reprisan again, and then, continuing the same direction, launched a second torpedo at the ship with two masts and three funnels. It saw one torpedo miss, and another explosion was heard, and under a hail of projectiles, none of which hit, it took off at full speed towards the south. Two other Japanese flotillas, several of those ships whose ships had lost contact with each other after the collision, between two of them, were less successful. They arrived too late to benefit from the surprise factor and made their attacks individually rather than by flotillas. Comparing the Japanese reports with the damage actually inflicted on the Russian ships, it would appear that the first flotilla, in the first 5 minutes of the attack, had done all the damage. And when the second and third flotillas came in, the Russians were wide awake, you would think so, and their searchlights and gunfire made close range and accurate torpedo firing impossible. The last attack was made by the destroyer Oboro around 2 a.m. Now this ship had been damaged in the collision and reached the scene an hour after her consorts when firing had long ceased. However, the Oboro was soon spotted and her attack was abortive. Now, something that I've been taken to task on by a couple of people when I wrote an article on this action was something that I discovered out of a communique from the period, and it concerned the fact that the Japanese predated by about 30-odd years the Italians in terms of that they used what could best be described as human torpedoes here in Port Arthur. A number of petty officers and officers volunteered to go over the side of their destroyers and swim alongside 18-inch and 14-inch fish inside the harbour, and when they got within range would strike the igniter, aim the fish in the general direction of a ship, and then when the torpedo went on its way try and swim back to where they started. Now none of these hit, and most of, or a fair proportion of, the men concerned were picked up. The water, of course, at that time of the year was absolutely freezing, and quite a few of them died. But they were treated very, very well by the Russians. As a matter of fact, there was a fair degree of humanity displayed on both sides during this entire conflict. And people have said that this is not true, it never happened. Well, this source, which was an independent source, neither Russian nor Japanese, is firmly of the opinion, and it did, and whilst a lot of people have debunked it, I've never seen it not in writing. And another thing that they reckon happened at the time was the next morning, 23 torpedoes were found on the beach. They'd just run up, stayed there, pistols screwed up tight, and all you'd have to do was flick a finger at them and they'd go off. This one has been copiously disagreed with, but once again it comes from the same source, and since he wasn't a journalist but an independent observer, I've got no reason to disbelieve him. But in any case, what he doesn't say is how they actually got rid of them. The Russians had torpedo nets out at the time, but the Japanese had anticipated this, and they put special net cutters on their fish, and the nets were actually very ineffectual. As a matter of fact, I don't think, although I mentioned a correction on this, I don't think the British discarded torpedo nets until about 1917. Of the torpedoes fired that night, most either missed or failed to explode. But luck was against the Russians insofar as quite a few hit the two newest battleships, the Retvazan and the Dzarevich, which were put out of action for months, as was the Pallada. Could I have the next shot, please, Gil? Now here's another scene from the action the next morning. There's the Pallada on the left. Well and truly on the bottom, as you can see, it's pretty shallow water. Now this battleship, I think, was the Tsarevich. As you can see, her military mast has been blown clean over the side, or dangling anyway, and her falls are empty, so quite a few people managed to get off. And of course you've always got the inevitable spectators who want to squat in the picture and have their picky taken. So tourists, I don't think, were an unknown quantity even at that time of the world. Next one, please, Kev. Now, many have said that the damage to the ships was light. That chap is actually standing in a hole made by what was really a lousy 14-inch fish in the side of the cruiser Pallada. Now, that was after the engineers had managed to, or after she'd put into dock, of course, but they did a pretty good job of engineering, because while she was still afloat or in the water, they managed to rivet a huge zinc patch over her side over that, and it was enough later on for them to pump her out and get her into dock. But she was well and truly out of action for many months, and that particular hit clobbered her fair in the boiler room. And judging by reports from the period, the fish did not come from a TBD, so it must have been one of the very few fish that was actually guided in by hand. But it's not a bad hole, I think you'll agree. On the 10th of February, 2 days after the attack at Chemulpo and Port Arthur, Japan declared war on Russia. So what it looks like, or what happened, was like Pearl Harbor, Japan actually opened up without declaring war. Now, the attack on Port Arthur has been debunked by many as not being of much worth. After all, they only got 3 ships, and even those went out of action. But the defeat was moral as well as physical, because it showed the Russians, who really didn't think much of the Japanese at that time, although they weren't really alone in that, they showed the Japanese to be a force to be reckoned with. The damage to their morale was colossal, because they thought they were invincible, now proven that they weren't. It showed also that one of their main fleet anchorages was vulnerable. It showed that the fleet anchorage was vulnerable. Like Pearl Harbor, a lot of ship positioning had been done by spies, paid informers working from shore. And all in all, it actually put the Russian Pacific Squadron behind to a considerable extent, and actually neutralized to a large extent the activities of Russian vessels in that area. On, as I say, on the 10th of February, Japan declared war on Russia. The latter, on the 9th of February, had already proclaimed her own declaration of war. The last to be informed, according to the Japanese official history of the war, were the Mikado's ancestors and the Japanese gods, who were not brought up to date with events until the 11th of February. So after that, everyone knew. The war brought outbursts of patriotism in both countries. In Japan, the Empress donated, would you believe, artificial eyes and limbs to the wounded, and personally helped to roll bandages, while at the other end of the social scale, a condemned murderer gave his life savings to the war effort. In Russia, those members of the government who had hankered after a minor war in order to rally a disaffected population around the Tsar seems to have been right, for there were patriotic demonstrations in most Russian cities. Meanwhile, the Tsarina and the Grand Duchesses, and everyone else on the sinister side of the blanket, organized hospital trains or enrolled as nurses, while school children learned rhymes about what was going to happen to the little yellow monkeys who would dare attack the Russian bear. Very partisan. The press in both countries proved more patriotic and warlike than even the governments, both reflecting and leading moral opinion. The morning after the surprise torpedo attack, Togo brought up his main forces, hoping to finish off the Russians or to at least inspect the damage. He found most of the Russian ships still outside Port Arthur, at anchor. There began an artillery duel between Togo's ships and the guns of the Russian ships and shore batteries. Togo made one of his few errors. He went up against a shore battery. That usually doesn't bode very well. Hits were scored by both sides, but on this occasion the Russians had the best of the encounter because the Japanese were hit pretty severely and they retired when things became a little bit too hot for them. It seemed that the Russian squadron was still a force to be reckoned with, and Togo could never relax so long as it could leave its harbour safely, break out and prey on the transports which would be taking the Japanese army to fight in Korea. So during the next few weeks there were many attacks on Port Arthur. These took the form of bombardments, destroyer attacks and three night attempts to sink block ships in the harbour entrance in order to bottle up the Russian ships. But these blocking attempts, even though they were pretty carefully organised and courageously executed, were failures because it was found impossible to position the block ships accurately under fire at night. But after the first attack, the Russian admiral had been relieved of his command and been replaced by Admiral Makarov, reputed to be Russia's most intelligent and energetic admiral. Under him, the Russian morale, which had sunk pretty low, began to improve, and anxious to give his crews proper training, he took the battleships to sea and actually exchanged shots with the Japanese, but was not yet risking a full-scale encounter with Togo's battle fleet. At dawn on the 13th of April, a Russian destroyer, creeping back to Port Arthur after an operation, was cut off by a Japanese cruiser outside the port, and Makarov immediately sent another cruiser to help, but the latter only succeeded in picking up five survivors of the destroyer before being approached by Japanese cruisers and was forced to retire. And Makarov, in vengeful mood, came out from Port Arthur with two battleships and three cruisers. Not wasting time over sweeping the harbour approaches for any mines the Japanese might have laid, which is to be his undoing, Makarov's ships chased after the Japanese cruisers for about 10 miles. Then, seeing the smoke of Togo's battle fleet on the horizon, he turned about and retired under protection of his shore batteries, but while he was cruising back along the coast, the Petropavlovsk, that was his flagship, struck a mine, and there was a thunderous explosion which shook the town of Port Arthur, followed by one or more other explosions. And according to one of the survivors, the explosion raised the battleship several feet in the air, and she lowered herself with a list. Then another couple of explosions occurred, because then a torpedo store went up, and that set off a magazine, and that set off some of the boilers. And of course she broke in two, and went to the bottom in 2 minutes. Makarov was last seen to take off his greatcoat and kneel down for a final prayer on the Admiral's bridge, and then the ship disappeared. And over 600 men went down with him, among them one of Russia's most famous war artists, Vereshchagin, who had come to Port Arthur to paint the war. Thus, in a few minutes, Russia had lost her most celebrated admiral and one of her most famous artists. However, another celebrity on board, Grand Duke Cyril, lived to fight another day and to become, a couple of decades later in Paris, self-styled Tsar Nick Cyril I in exile. A few minutes after the Petropavlovsk went down, another battleship which had just left Port Arthur struck another mine. At this, the entire force went berserk, firing its guns at the water and an impression that a submarine attack was in progress. But after this cannonade ceased, the damaged battleship was towed safely back to harbour, and they lost one of their finest admirals. Togo, too, had had a black day. On the 15th of May, he lost one cruiser by collision and two battleships from mines. Now, mines were a Russian specialty. They're always very good at it, and they still are. Most of the mines that were actually cleared from Vietnam were of Russian manufacture, and according to some reports, they were very efficient. They were also specialists in artillery, and it was actually Joseph Stalin who referred to artillery as the god of war. And when the Japanese got into Port Arthur, the Russians were quite surprised that somebody else was as good as them. So, Japanese naval supremacy was also being challenged by the activities of Russian cruisers stationed at Vladivostok. The Russian armoured cruiser squadron at Vladivostok, consisting of three ships, the Gromoboy, the Rossiya, and the Rurik, had made several raids on Japanese shipping. Although the press of Japan, Britain, and the USA had made much of the unheroic nature of attacks on unarmed vessels, this could hardly hide the fact that these three vessels were a menace to the Japanese war plans. The cruises of these ships usually lasted about a week, and they seemed to have no difficulty passing through the Tsugaru Straits, but one of their victims was a heavily loaded Japanese troop ship whose cargo was refused to surrender and which was sent to the bottom. Now, British hackles were raised when a British steamer carrying coal to Japan was captured, and in July the squadron wreaked havoc on shipping near Yokohama, and for a time sailings from Japanese ports had to be suspended. The Japanese Admiral Kamimura commanded the armoured cruiser squadron and had been charged with intercepting the intruders, but they continually evaded him. But by this time the Japanese public's blood was up, and it vented its spleen on Kamimura for not getting the ships, and even his house was attacked and damaged by a mob. However, in August, Kamimura did in fact catch up with the Russian squadron, and in greatly superior force managed to actually sink the Rurik and damage others, and henceforth the Vladivostok ships were less venturesome. Both navies continued to aid their land forces in the siege of Port Arthur. In general, Togo detached his older ships to form an inshore bombarding squadron, and from time to time these ships suffered loss by mines. And Togo was not willing to risk his newer ships, which in any case were probably a little more effective for this kind of work. The Russians, despite the Japanese blockade, were able to make use of fog and darkness and to send gunboats and destroyers to bombard shore targets. The bigger ships did make one sortie, but their main contribution was guns and men for the landward defence. As the Japanese got closer, however, the battleships were occasionally used as merely artillery platforms in harbour, bombarding Japanese positions from their anchorage. And towards the end of June, the Tsarevich, which you saw there on the screen, finished its repairs. This was being one of the last of the ships torpedoed in the surprise attack in February to be returned from service, in much the same way as it was pretty slow for the American battleship sunk at Pearl Harbor to return. Actually, all three of them went back into service. The Russian Admiral Vitkev thereupon informed his captains that the time had come to quit Port Arthur and to defeat the enemy at sea. And on June 23rd, the Russian squadron emerged. First came the light cruiser Novik and the destroyers, together with minesweepers to clear the harbor defenses. Then came the main force of four cruisers and six battleships, the last leaving about midday. Discovering an unswept mine, Vitkev ordered sweeping to continue and the big ships to drop anchor. About a dozen mines were exploded, and after this two-hour intermission, the squadron got underway at once. Its aim was to make a reconnaissance, and, should it meet the enemy, to give battle. After it had progressed 9 miles and exchanged fire with shadowing Japanese destroyers, Togo's main force was sighted. In view of the superior Japanese numbers, Vitkev decided to return. Close to Port Arthur, in the darkness, Japanese destroyers and torpedo boats attacked his ships but caused little damage, although the battleship Sevastopol was slightly damaged by a mine. The squadron dropped anchor outside the port and at dawn began to pass safely back into the inner harbour. But a big battle of the time, the Battle of the Yellow Sea, took place on the 10th of August. Vitkev, in view of the advance of the Japanese army near Port Arthur, had been instructed to break out and make for Vladivostok. On the 9th of August, all preparations were made, and on the 10th day, cheered on by the local population, the squadron left. It has been argued that whatever happened, the objective which all ships should pursue was the transfer of naval strength from Port Arthur to Vladivostok. The Russian force consisted of 6 battleships, with Vitkev flying his flag in the Tsarevich, that was number 1 in the line, and his second-in-command, one Prince Oktomsky, in the Perestroika, number 4 in the line. There was a cruiser squadron of 3 ships, 8 destroyers led by the cruiser Novik, and following at a suitable distance, a hospital ship. I think that was the Ural. By 10, the harbour defences had been cleared of mines, and the minesweepers returned to port as the main force got underway, and had advanced into the open sea at about 13 knots, which wasn't bad considering that the flat-out speed of a line of battleship in those days was about 17 to 18 knots. And it was not long before various Japanese squadrons could be seen approaching from 3 directions. Among them was Togo's battle fleet, consisting of the 4 surviving battleships. I say surviving because although the Russians didn't know it, he'd lost both the Hashima and the Hattus to mines earlier on. Now, since Japan only had 6 main battleships at this stage, that means that Togo's force had been reduced by fully one-third, And this information didn't reach Russian ears until well after the war was over. If they had known it, it would have proved a tremendous psychological advantage to them. But they managed to keep mum about it, and nobody even found out. This force manoeuvred as to cut off the Russians, and the latter responded by altering course, and for a time the two battle fleets lay on parallel courses and exchanged fire, both sides suffering some damage. However, this exchange soon ceased, and would you believe, Witkieft ordered all hands to lunch. The Japanese squadron apparently did the same, because it was later in the afternoon they hoisted the pick again and managed to get into a position where the Russians would be forced to give battle. Firing commenced at 8,000 yards, which was unreal for those days, because main battle practice, even in the British Navy, was about 3,000 yards. That was what they usually aimed at with main armament. And gradually the two forces drew closer. At first, both sides seemed evenly matched, each inflicting as much damage as it received. On the flagship Macassar, there were several hits, one of which almost killed Togo. He actually got a shell splinter through the thigh, but he didn't budge, he just kept on his flag bridge and directed the battle. The Japanese ships also suffered from premature explosion of their own shells whilst still in the barrel. Now, this had a somewhat disconcerting effect on the gunners. Towards 18:30 hours, the Japanese battleships concentrated their fire on the Tsarevich, which received, would you believe, 15 12-inch shells in rapid succession, not to speak many of smaller calibre. At 18:40 hours, a shell hit the battleship close to the conning tower, killing Admiral Witkieft and most of his staff and the helmsman, and the steering jammed and the Tsarevich began to turn in circles. Now, this threw the Russian column into complete confusion, with some ships turning towards the enemy and others away. There was no, in either this or Tsushima itself, no direct chain of command, and this was a fatal mistake, because there was no cohesion following the death of the commander. The Japanese took advantage of this confusion to approach closer and to direct a withering fire at this huddle of Russian battleships. At Tomsky, the nominal second command, who was virtually ineffective, finally sensed that he had become commander and discovered that the signal halyards of his ship had been shot away. But he managed to eventually hoist a signal on the funnel which said, "Follow me," and he made back at full speed towards Port Arthur, completely forgetting his objective. The rest of the battleship followed him as best they could, with the exception of the still circling Tsarevich and three cruisers. The latter, led by the Askold, the cruiser Askold, broke through the line of encircling Japanese ships and made for Vladivostok, successfully beating off torpedo attacks. Some of the Russian destroyers also made off. Meanwhile, until nightfall, Togo pursued the main Russian battleships, and then he withdrew, leaving the field clear for his torpedo boats and destroyers. During the night, the unhappy Russian squadron endured successive attacks, but the Japanese caused more damage to themselves than to the Russians. At least two Japanese torpedo craft were damaged by a collision, and another was torpedoed by its own side, so it wasn't too good. No torpedoes struck the Russian ships, and it would have been hard to find a better demonstration of the seaborne ineffectiveness of the torpedo, which had hitherto been so feared as a new, unbeatable, and destructive weapon. The next morning, the battleships re-entered Port Arthur, but not to the accompaniment of bands and cheering crowds. Of all the mistaken decisions committed by Russian commanders in the entire war, Oktomsky's decision was probably the most damaging. If only half his ships had managed to reach Vladivostok, the strategic picture would have been greatly changed to Togo's disadvantage. Togo was already concerned about reports of strong Russian reinforcements arriving from the Baltic, and he was counting on eliminating the existing Russian fleet well before the arrival of new Russian ships. His own ships needed repair, their gun barrels were damn near worn out, and if Oktomsky's battleships had reached Vladivostok, Togo might have been caught between two fires when the 2nd Pacific Squadron arrived. As for the ships which did break through towards Vladivostok, none of them arrived. The Novik got as far as the Sakhalin Peninsula, where she ran aground and was discovered by Japanese cruisers and destroyed. The Askold had her funnels badly damaged. Now, this may not seem much, but in those days, when you forced draft wasn't particularly effective. The actual draft you could get from the funnels was one of the most important factors in fuel economy and the amount of fuel you'd use and the amount of steam you could raise. And to get your funnels badly holed, especially further down towards their base, it was the more or less modern day equivalent of being dismasted, because you couldn't raise enough steam to get out of the way, and this is what caught more ships than one would think possible. The Askold, having two damaged funnels, lacked sufficient coal to reach Vladivostok and needed repairs to her hull, so she ended up at Shanghai, where she was interned for the duration of the war. The cruiser Diana went to Saigon, where she was disarmed and interned by the French. As for the Tsarevich, this ship was also attacked by torpedo boats during the night following the battle, but she too escaped with no damage. However, she had been severely mauled by the gunfire of the previous day, and her funnels were badly damaged, and were so badly damaged her coal consumption was so high that it was totally out of the question for her to go to Vladivostok. So she ended up in the German port of Kiacho, where she was interned. Now, Kev, could I have the next shot, please? This is the Pobieda, Russian battleship Pobieda, which was representative of the time. She has absolutely towering sides, and any of those of you who have memories of the criticisms levelled at the county class would think that they were light destroyers in comparison. General armament had forward, 2 12-inch, low calibre, and dotted all along her sides, casemented weapons, generally of anything between 6-inch and about 3 pounders, and they usually carried a bow chaser, although in this one wasn't added. Next one, please, Kev. This is the Russian Imperial yacht, the Standart. Why I've got this ship in is that the Russian commander at Tsushima was actually received on board the Standart as a guest of the Tsar in circumstances which I'll relate later, because he was commended as being the finest gunnery officer in the Russian fleet. But if you look at that ship, you think, well, there's something familiar about her, and it's not generally known, next please, Greg, that she was the inspiration for the Victoria and Albert. Now, the Tsar, the Standart was completed in 1895, and you can see from the date here, which is a direct pinch from Jones, that V&A was completed in 1899. V&A wasn't a particularly well-built ship, oddly enough. She had at least 500 tons of concrete in her to keep her upright, because they'd made a miscalculation in designing her, and before she was launched, she actually turned turtle in dock. Next, please, Kev. We go on to the 2nd Pacific Squadron, which came out under circumstances which are next to relieve the 1st Pacific Squadron, which got well and truly shattered. Now, these ships followed French practice. Could I have the next shot, please, Kev? Here's her, that was the Naya Suvarov, the last one, which was actually the flagship. This is her sister ship, the Orel. Now, French practice was adhered to mainly in the Russian main fleets. You'll notice they had a very, very short forecastle here, very much accentuated tumble helm, a short stern, a horrendously high freeboard, and as you can see, those funnels were close on 110 feet from the boiler grates to the top. This particular class of ship, of which there was four, the Suvarov, the Orel, the Borodino, and the Emperor Alexander III, formed the principal units of the 2nd Pacific Squadron. 2nd Pacific Squadron, cranky. Next, please. They were developed directly from the French practice, as I said, and this is an immediate ancestor to the Naya Suvarov. As you can see, the similarities are absolutely striking. The small forecastle here, tall funnels, although the French have got an early form of smoke baffle on them, the towering military mast, which the Americans use to a great extent. This particular one is the Goloys. She was about 12,000 tons, could average about 18 knots, was completed in 1896, and with a pretty high fuel consumption as well. You can see here towards the stern the slope away of the sides and a vestige here of the old central battery system which preceded this type of class. Next please, please. This is her immediate ancestor. This is the French 12,000 ton battleship Redoutable. Yes, it's a battleship of the time. Here is your central battery here, and this enormous tumble ham which was meant to provide fore and aft fire for the heavy guns in this casement here. The ram bow was very much in vogue. The French used it almost to an extreme, along with the early German ships. She was originally square rigged, but very rarely actually used her rig, and later on was in fact converted to more or less a modern layout with a military mast forward. She could steam at about 17 knots, coal consumption at full speed was almost 20 tons per hour, which was enormous. She had locomotive boilers in terms of they were cylindrical. Water tube boilers hadn't come in when this ship was built. And whilst they were pretty reliable, they weren't exactly economical, but they were the best the day could offer. Next, please, Dick. This is a casemented 5.4-inch French gun. And this was the same pattern as used in casements on board the Russian vessels of the time, and to a lesser extent the Japanese. It was a crude breech loader. It did have a crude form of recoil mechanism, although they bucked horribly and sometimes even jumped clean off their training tracks, which you can see here is what they call a barbet mounting. And it did have the Nordenfelt screw breech, but they were pretty slow to load and it was a divided round even for a calibre as small as 5.4. The Russian equivalent of the direct equivalent was actually a 6-inch, but these weapons were pretty much the norm up until about just before the First World War, even though, of course, they're on a more modern mounting than that. This mounting was of an 1884 pattern, but it was pretty common for quite some time. Next, please, Chris. Now, I've included this picture, which is of the American battleship Mississippi, which is being built, to give you a fair idea of the layout of how they're being built. Here you can see a turret still in the process of completion. It's beamed fully. There's an afterbridge here, which in the later classes was usually deleted. And there were pretty shallow draft. Now the Mississippi was actually smaller than normal, and she approximated, and was alone in this, along with her sister ship, the Idaho. She approximated the size of the Russian vessels in this action. As a matter of fact, both she and her sister ship, the Idaho, ended up going to the Greeks. And they didn't finally get put paid to until the Second World War, when they were bombed in Salamis, I believe it was. Both of them went to the bottom. But they were, unfortunately for them, never really successful ships, because they were only the only two of their class in size, and they could never fit into a homogeneous pattern. But as you can see, there's not much freeboard here, and the guardrails are up. It's only about 10 feet down up.
Next, please.
This is the battleship Ozliabaya, Russian battleship Ozliabaya. Now, she had didn't have 12-inch at all. She was armed with 10-inch. The Russians seemed to go for 10-inch, and she had four of them in a twin turret forward and aft. She is a sister ship of that vessel that you saw on her side in Port Arthur. She also had 11 6-inch mounted in casements all along her sides, 20 12-pounders, and 26 smaller quickfires, including Gatling guns. And she had three sets of triple expansion engines, 30 Belleville water tube boilers, designed horsepower is 14,500, and when new she could actually make 19 knots. But the boiler pressure was only 165 pounds. And she was laid down in 1895, and as a demonstration, she wasn't completed until 1901. Next, Kev. This is the Navarin, the only one of her type. For obvious reasons, she was known as the factory. Four funnels, two abreast. She also had four 12-inch, and except for the funnels, was modelled on the British Majestic class. Now, some of the quality of some of these photographs isn't very good, but photographs of any sort around about this period are scarce, and unfortunately I had to make do with what I could get. Her coal consumption was very high. Now, even though she was designed for 16 knots, she was absolutely busting her boilers to get 40 knots. She steered badly. She made very bad weather because of this characteristic very low freeboard forecastle. But her one saving grace was that she was a very, very steady gun platform. And she was laid down at St. Petersburg in 1899. Sorry, I said Majestics. I meant the British Trafalgar class. And total cost, when you think of it in today's terms, when you can pay upwards of 40 million for a lousy destroyer, total cost for this 10,000 tonner was only £750,000. So I often wonder today whether we're actually getting value for money. Next, please. Oh, by the way, it's all right, but she actually had 12 cylindrical boilers. Thank you. This is the Sissoi Veliki. When she first came out, she was hailed as the last thing in battleship design from the Russians. She was only a 9,000 tonner, and once again she had 4 12-inch, but in this time, instead of 40 to 45 caliber guns, as in the previous classes, hers were pretty short, they were 35s, a pretty low power. But she also packed in 6 6-inch, 12 3-pounder guns, 24 1-pounder Nordenfelts, and 2 torpedo tubes above water and 6 below, and they were 18 inches. But she had French armour, a 16-inch belt of it, of Crusoe steel, French. That was all around. Deck protection minimal, but she had 5-inch armour on bulkheads and 12 inches on the faces of the turrets. She was twin screw, 2 sets triple expansion, cylindrical boilers once again, laid down in June 1894. Design speed was 16 knots. Engineering notes are interesting. Coal consumption of this ship is enormous. She recorded on one occasion at full power 30 tons of coal per hour, which, when you consider how far this ship eventually had to go from the Baltic to the Far East, well, they had some fun feeding her furnaces. Even though she was designed for approximately 16 knots, the best she could make, even when brand spanking new, was only 15.4 knots. Next ship. This ship, and the ones that are going to follow it, should never have gone to the Far East. She was designed as a coast defence ship only. She was only 4,200 tons, and her sole claim to fame was that she carried 3 45 calibre 10-inch guns, 2 forward, 1 aft. Now, because she was a coast defence ship, it means, of course, she had a reasonably shallow draft, and so to get anything like the amount of steam out of the boilers that they should get, to get her design speed of about 16 knots, and even that was under forced draft, she was possessed of 2 of the tallest funnels in the Russian Navy, from the boiler plates to the top. Oddly enough, even though she was a coast defence ship, when she finally got out to the Far East, she turned out to be one of the most accurate ships of the lot, and she caused damage out of all proportion to her size, and she had a 10-inch belt of Harvey armour, American armour, along her sides, and 8 inches on the turrets. And besides the 3 10-inch guns, she had 4 4.7s, and 4 above-water torpedo tubes, so even in their close defence ships, the Russians made damn certain that they could take care of themselves. Next, please, Jeff. Now, these two vessels, of which there's only one illustration, are very similar to the others, and they're approximately the same tonnage, the Admiral Ushakov and the Admiral Senyavin. And these ones had only 4 9-inch 45 caliber guns. And when they went out to the Far East, their behaviour at sea was appalling. But they were the last that could be got up from a rather tatterdemalion squadron at best, and anything that could float, have engines and fire, guns went out. And she had also cylindrical boilers, and once again, to get any sort of speed out of her at all, they had to go to resort to forced draft, and she could only make about 12 knots flat out. Next, Kev. Now here is a real good one. This was the Dmitry Donskoy, one of the most ancient cruisers in the Russian fleet. She was laid down in 1883 as an armoured cruiser, and she carried only six-inch guns, and those were all in casements. She had nothing in turrets. She was virtually a broadside ship, similar to the format that had been in for 500 years. And her sole claim to fame was that she was steel, she had pretty good armour, and she could actually move. But she put the laugh to everyone, because at Tsushima, she fought one of the hardest fights of the lot. She actually succeeded in sinking two Japanese cruisers. She fought harder than any other ship in the action. She actually burnt all her gun barrels out, and she went down without surrendering, which is something of a rarity in those days. She had a 7.5-inch belt and had armour on her decks, 2 inches of it. And she had 4 torpedo tubes, twin screws, and she could actually go as fast as some of the more modern stuff, damn near 16 knots. Next please, Kev. And here's her sister ship, the Vladimir Monomakh. But she was a bit earlier, 1881. Now she was lucky, because before she went out to join the fleet, she had a complete mechanical overhaul. She had new engines, 2 sets triple expansion, which was pretty much the norm for the day, and a full 10-inch belt of armour, and she was a hard one to kill. But once again, she was underarmed for her tonnage, and she carried only 5 6-inch guns and 6 4.7s. You'll notice that I'm quoting mainly British gun diameter here. Well, the Russians did this. In those days, they were copyists, and they pretty much followed the gunnery party line in terms of sticking to well-tried and true designs. Next, please, Kev. Here is the Admiral Nakhamov. Now, don't take any notice of this lot, because it means she was sunk, which she was. But she was pretty well modernised. Now, in her day, she was known as a battleship, but she wasn't by that time. She'd had her big stuff removed and replaced by 8 6-inch. And she had, once again, a very heavy armour belt of 10 6-inch, and a towering stern, as I've seen in other photographs, almost stern windows, almost like Nelson's Victory. So if you got an end-on fire onto her, you could practically put round shot through her from one end to the other. But that new machinery went into her in 1899, and she was actually fitted with Belleville boilers on this occasion, Belleville water tube boilers of a French pattern. And she was built in 1885. She was one of the oldest, even though her design doesn't look it. She made 17.5 knots new, but after re-engineing, she was the only ship in the Russian fleet whose speed actually improved. After new engines and given a haircut and a shave, she actually made about 18.5 knots, and on one occasion when she was chasing a Japanese battleship, she was chasing it, she did 19 knots, and I don't know how they did it, but I have a funny feeling that the captain's wardrobe must have gone into the furniture, into the furnaces as well. Now, she was only 8,000 tons, but she carried damn near 2,000 tons of coal, so it amounts to the fact that fully one quarter of her entire displacement tonnage was taken up with her bunkers. She had 2 above-water torpedo tubes, which she never fired in her life. Next, kid. Now, I've never been able to make out what that ship reminds me of. It reminds me of a Cocker Spaniel lying down, I think. But that's her main turret there, and that was it. That's all she had. 2 12-inch, very short barrel, 30 caliber. They'd be going to get 5 miles out of them. Towering sides. You couldn't miss hitting her, even at 10 miles. She was as slow as a wet week. She could only do about 14 knots, and she was actually the flagship of the backup squadron. She, just before leaving for the fleet, her old cylindrical boilers were actually replaced by Belvilles taken out of the Imperial yacht. They were getting a bit desperate. But they weren't exactly suited to the job, and they wore out pretty quickly. And she actually carried 12 6-inches well, but I'm afraid she wasn't particularly good, but she was a hell of a hard ship to kill. The Japanese actually ended up capturing her, together with the flag officer. She had a 14-inch belt of armour, which nobody succeeded in getting through. Next, please, Kim. Now, I've only got one photograph here, and it's a pretty bad one, I must admit, but this is the small Russian cruisers, or represents the small Russian cruisers, the Jemchug and the Izumrud. Now, these ships were very similar to the Novak, which was lost in the early part of the war, but they couldn't steam as fast as that ship anyway. And even though they have a displacement tonnage of only 3,050 tons, their coal consumption was absolutely horrendous. And you might mention a figure of 25 tons I mentioned earlier, or 30 tons I mentioned earlier. These ships burned fuel at the rate of 25 tons an hour at full speed. Now, not unnaturally, they couldn't keep that up for long. It was a bit of an insult, really, because she did that on 16 British Yarrow boilers. But I must admit, they were fast. She could do 24 knots flat out. So the same figures would apply to both ships. That's both the Jemchug and the Izumrud. Actually, the Izumrud ended up being upsunk, and the Jemchug was interned in Korea. Next, please. This beautiful yacht-like vessel was the only one of her type. This is the Almaz. She was actually a cruiser. She could go like the wind, but that was about her only claim to fame. She was completely unarmored, and she had 16 Belvoir boilers. She could make about 22 knots, but she had only 4 12-pounder guns, and she was classed as a cruiser. Well, she didn't do much good in the war. I'm not too sure what happened to her. I've got no information on her at all. She just seems to have disappeared out of the action. Next, please, Kip. This is the Aurora. Now, I noticed from the last issue of the review that some questions were asked about the Aurora. Well, I've got a fair amount of information about her. She was present at Tsushima and was able to escape in a damaged condition to Manila, where she was interned for the remainder of the war. She later returned to the Baltic, and after a passive role during the First World War, was credited with firing the first shot of the October Revolution in 1917. And after the Civil War, she was used as a training ship and permanently stationed at Leningrad after 1930. In 1941, she was engaged in bombarding the Germans' positions near Oriendan before she sank in shallow water after being bombed. Her guns were removed and were used ashore on an armoured train. Following the close of the war, she was salved, her guns recovered, and she was converted into a floating museum, Kev, next, where she now is in Leningrad, and there she is, she's still afloat.